I can vlog. Oh, go ahead, Justin. Let's fight over it.
Go first.
Okay. I wanted to share, okay, so timer started. I wanted to share something that Jess and I had just, it's very kind of, well, something that we put together over the last couple of months, I guess, or something that I kind of did a bit of a brain dump, and then Jess, I think you then went in and added some stuff, and it was related to inclusive design critique. So just thinking about, and I'm going to drop, how should I best do this? I can drop a link to the Google Doc in the chat here. And how would there be a better way to share that with folks? I can share my screen, I suppose. I'm aware that I need to, I only have 2 minutes. So let me just, should have been a little more prepared so that, here we go. 1 second, sorry. Oh my gosh, now I'm totally lost my dog. Isn't that awesome? Okay, here we are. Okay. This is just the document that I mentioned. So I kind of went through and dropped in some ideas about how to do inclusive critique, and would love any input or feedback from anybody. And just interject if you have anything you want to say. But yeah, so I'll just quickly kind of go through it. And some of these ideas were just from my own experience. And then I think I also looked at one or two things, and I'm trying to remember for reference what those were, but right now I'm not entirely sure, but mostly it was kind of from my own reflection and experience. And so just kind of thought about the spirit of, it's a spirit of generosity when you're doing a critique. So offering criticism is actually kind of the idea that it's actually kind of a gift, and that just being aware that presenting work can be kind of a vulnerable thing. Asking questions when you really do have a question, but otherwise if you actually have a feedback, not couching it sort of in a question, but trying to be direct about that. And sometimes you can start with, as the person presenting, you can start with saying what you want the group to focus on. That can be helpful. You can try having everyone say one positive thing first. The receiver of the critique can always just say, I'll think about that, or okay, great, thank you. And not, you don't need to, you know, respond necessarily right in the moment, but you can take time to process it and reflect on it. Sometimes I find, I know this was not my idea, but somewhere I read this, that once you put the work out there, it's no longer kind of belongs to you. So that helps with kind of distancing yourself a bit from it, or not taking things personally. Again, I said constructive feedback is a gift. So just considering your motivation when offering that feedback, if it will help the person further develop the work. I like it is nice to hear, but maybe not very constructive. So trying to flesh that out with why you like it. What would you like to see more of, see develop further? And then this last point is kind of just a multi-point about fostering a space of open creativity. So letting so-called mistakes or bad ideas be good things, not kind of shutting things down before they've been explored. Obviously, this is maybe obvious, but not, you know, avoiding any kind of hostility or ridicule, even subtly. And checking in with your own feelings sometimes can help. Maybe saying things like, can you tell me more about that, or paraphrasing back, and maybe offering a different version. So these are just a collection of kind of pretty quickly dumped ideas. And then Jess, I know you use this in your class, so I don't know if we have any time left, but I could say more about that.
Yeah, so the two minutes is definitely too short. I think we'll go with 5 minutes going forward. I think it,
okay, I see your chat. Yeah. There.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I don't know, Jess, do you want to add based on your experience of using this?
First of all, thank you, Dina, for putting some of this together. I'm teaching a class on Wednesday nights, and I said to the students that as an introduction to this, that you know, the practicing critique is something that is a practice. Like, it's something that you can get better at, and it can feel very awkward at first. And so for that week's class, we practiced critiquing, and sure enough, it was awkward at some times, and we reflected on its awkwardness. But I said that my colleague Dana was the best that I'd ever seen at receiving and giving critique. And so I'd asked Dana to put some of these thoughts together so that we could share them with the students. A couple of things that they really jammed on, Dana, and I hadn't had a chance to tell you this yet. One was the notion of taking time before reacting. Some of the students had had experience with that, and they talked about how challenging it is, but how they found it was really, really helpful. The other was, we as a class talked about, how do you create an environment where it feels okay to do this? So some of the students said, you know, starting out with ideas like, hey, that reminds me of something else, is a really great way to create that kind of sharing environment. So it may not be critique. They may not think of it as critique, more as conversation or communication in general, but some of the students said, hey, that reminds me of this, or hey, I'm thinking about this, what do you think? And then it starts this conversation, which was really lovely. And I think it gets at that first point, which is so essential, that spirit of generosity, figuring out how to do that. The other is, the students were really, they're really being very sort of thoughtful and reflective of this. They wondered why they felt so attached to something they had worked on, and why it felt so risky and so personal to put it out there. So I thought that those were really some interesting bits of feedback.
Cool, thanks. Yeah, and I know you had some links that you recommended to your class, Jess, that I thought maybe we can add in here, because, yeah, there's a Medium article and something else. I can dig and find them too, that we can add here afterward, but that are some interesting articles on critique.
Yeah, that's awesome. I think I just hear, like, seeing this document, I can see that this is useful, not just for a classroom situation, but this reminds me of, like, the potluck, Cheryl, that you did at the Platform Co-op conference, where something like this as a guideline could be good for, to help frame discussion, right? Sort of, it has, like, broad usage.
Yeah, for sure. I think that would be super helpful, because often people are just, like, super polite in gatherings, especially when they don't know everyone, right? So I think guidelines like this, and as you said, practicing it even, just would be super useful.
And I'm thinking about the, because I'm an educational developer, and sometimes we do focus group with students, so I'm thinking about the role of the instructor here. Because sometimes I think that sometimes instructors let the students say it first, and then they are the last ones to give the critique. So some students may think, okay, that is the only one that counts. So I don't know how you guys deal with that. Because I apologize, I don't have an art and design background. So I've never done critique myself. So I was just wondering about that.
Jess, maybe you want to comment as one who has instructed and used this.
Well, I mean, you should take it with a very large grain of salt, like a giant clump of sea salt, Himalayan sea salt, the pink kind, because it's just my experience. But this was really helpful to have as kind of our starting point to look at this list, because we genuinely were practicing this. So I'd asked the students to get together in groups, and for the second portion of the class, they came up with a design solution, and it really was very silly. Like, the design solution itself was less important. What I asked them to do afterwards was get up in front of the rest of the class and present it as a group, so everybody in the group got the practice of working together and being inclusive and collaborative. And then the class was asked to critique their their project or their presentation. So there was this meta thing going on where they would ask questions of the group that was presenting, and we would stop in the middle of it and say, okay, so take a look at our critique, you know, guidelines or our critique encouragements or provocations. Instead of saying that you like it, tell me, you know, what do you like about it? So I wound up playing the role of the facilitator almost in helping both of the groups that were presenting understand how to be inclusive in the presenting of the thing. And then the students who were critiquing it, helping them understand how to critique it in a way that got at the thing rather than the presentation of it, that expressed some curiosity. So it was guided, it was facilitated, I guess, is the way.
Hi, this is Karen. This is really interesting. So, you know, I second the learning from Dana and critiquing, and especially the idea that any feedback in a critique is like a little gift. I love that. I wear that here whenever I'm giving or receiving, and that's been really helpful. I spent many years teaching design at OCAD, actually, and critique was a huge, and this is a while ago, before I was practicing inclusive design and inclusion in education, and critique was, you know, critique day, everybody was nervous, and so the student was a very much a student and teacher sort of, there was a division. So the critique, the students were really waiting for critique from the teacher, the educator. And so it's a very interesting, flip. Like for me, this approach is the actual critique actually becomes a part of the learning. And what you're doing, Jess, like what you're talking about, you and Dana, is that, yeah, that the students, every aspect of it, the students are involved and they're learning the critique. And so I think one of the things by, if I'm a student coming into the class and there's going to be a critique around a piece of work that I've just done, and it's the identifying the goal, sort of what the goal is, and perhaps some of the key things that you're looking for. I learned that most recently with this wonderful group at the IDRC, like really sort of helping to guide that so that you get that feedback that's directed, that helps, I think, the person whose work it is, because you're prepared for that. You're prepared for some feedback in those sort of areas. It can then expand out, but it helps sort of ground you. I find for me personally, and I think, you know, we probably all fall in that bucket of it can be uncomfortable when you're presenting something that's yours, that you've worked on. But I love that idea of it all. It's sort of the learners owning the critique, and that the educator is guiding it. And there's often opportunities to stop, as you were saying, Jess, to stop and talk about something that expands. It's sort of these opportunities to expand on a learning moment sort of thing.
And one of those, Karen, was back to Dana's point that, you know, these are gifts, and that what was the point? My brain is fried. It stops being yours when you share it. The students got to practice ideas coming from somebody else who wasn't in their group that would help move their idea forward. So it was kind of extraordinary, because they were letting go of, the students who were presenting were letting go of the thing that they had put together, and they were practicing being in the position of somebody else who wasn't involved in that group, having a great idea that they hadn't thought of. And that can be one of those things, I think, that's a little bit hard to hear, especially if you've got a group of people who've been sitting together for hours, you know, thinking about a particular topic, and then just to hear that somebody who's asking questions comes up with something you hadn't thought of. They got to practice that not being a failure, but that being an opportunity, as you're saying, Karen, that was a reminder that great design ideas come from anywhere, and that if you can create the dynamic of that creative environment and the sharing environment, that you can all contribute to making this thing better, and that was the gift of critique.
That's very cool. Yeah, and the value of often, sort of these quicker cycles, so that you're getting feedback. So in theory, the idea that you're not holding on to something and becoming where you've spent this much time and you've got more of an ownership to it, that it's very difficult to sort of let go of an idea. So I find that that's the other thing when it comes to learners in a classroom, is having more of those touch points so there is iterative feedback, and critiques like that can be helpful.
Yeah, and I think it helps with that idea of collaboration, and it's not just what I did, but once I put it out there, as you guys are saying, now we're all working together and the work continues. It didn't stop when I finished, it continues, it's just a different stage. Mm-hmm. And I also like how the instructor becomes the facilitator, giving the students that the realization that the instructor is not the only expert in the classroom. There's a lot of experts, and giving them more confidence that they can also come up with very good points to continue this collaboration. Yeah, with the students.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that also goes out beyond the classroom in environments where there's design teams, where, you know, there's this, I'll throw this out, traditionally there's this expression that I've often heard designers and a lot of designers who have educated in, you know, the 80s and 90s and that everyone's a designer. And, you know, I was in a meeting the other day and I said, well, but everybody is. So it's just how we present, you know, it's about how we take that information, and coming back to that, every piece of information and critique that you get is a gift. And regardless of who it's from. So even outside of the classroom, in boardrooms, you know, it's that sort of taking that practice out into that environment is important as well, I think.
And speaking of facilitating this feedback, and especially I've seen this happen in design teams before, especially with teams that are like really afraid to give feedback. I've seen this tool being used called the six thinking hats. Don't know if you folks have heard about it before. It's like the idea that I'll post a link in the chat of a slide that kind of explains it, but this could really be adapted to whatever. So the idea is that you put on a hat and that kind of, definitely this is something that's used, but this hat kind of assigns you a role or the different things that you can kind of say. So for example, a blue hat is for process, right? A white hat means that you share information or facts that are needed. A red hat is you share your feelings and intuition. Green hat is generating ideas. Black hat is what might be difficult or what you might have to take caution of. And yellow hat is positive and aspects and benefits. So I mean, these can all be changed to whatever suits the group and suits, you know, what you're trying to get out of it. But I find that this almost gives people permission, especially if they're feeling a little shy.
It's like a more elaborate talking stick.
Yes, it's a color-coded talking stick.
Okay, cool.
Great. Thanks, everybody.
Yeah. Awesome.
I just wanted to say, too, the idea of it as feedback as a gift is not mine, and I'm pretty sure came from, I put a link in here to Crazy Lions on Constructive Criticism. I'm pretty sure that's where it came from, but anyway. Thanks.
Cool. That's awesome. Okay, anyone else have a tool, process, or experience that they would like to share the group? And I will give a 5 minute. Instead of 2 minutes, I will set it to a 5 minute timer. Because I don't like silence. I could volunteer to go if no one else has anything. You're waving? Gregor, you want to go? I can't hear you. No, audio is not working now. Oh no. No, your audio is still not working.
While they get their audio working, I can share something which I have made no notes for, and I have not written anything down or will point to anything. But I suspect there are humans here who could support what I'm saying. The thing I wanted to talk about is not facilitating, or facilitating the minimum amount required, particularly relating to co-design. And what I love about it is the fact that it enables participants in co-design to feel like they are co-designers, that they have equal energy to bring and equal responsibility for what comes out of it. It worked out fairly well for Dana and I when we were in India, because we didn't have perfect translation and most of the people in the room didn't speak English, and we don't speak Gujarati. So we couldn't actually over facilitate, and it worked out amazingly. What came out of that session was that the women that we were working with figured out that some of what had been decided upon from above was not what the actual women participating wanted to do with their co-op. And through that process, they reworked what they were doing and how they went forward. So I felt that was a huge win. It didn't come out in the way that we would have expected. We didn't end up, that particular co-op didn't end up being a full participant in the co-op work in general, but I think it was a huge win for Seva and a huge win for the women participating. That was my share.
Thanks. Thanks, Michelle.
Can you guys hear us now?
Yep. Oh, okay. Yeah, there we go. So I have a question, Michelle, about minimal facilitating as a way of sort of fostering an inclusive collaborative design process. So how I'd imagine that could feel a little bit awkward starting that off. Can you share a little bit of like how it played out in reality for you, and how is it that you sort of got everyone to a place where they were all sort of comfortable and that they were the ones driving the process?
Well, I would say that we never get to a point where everybody's comfortable. It is awkward and it is messy, because we have a whole bunch of people that are coming together to do a thing, and there isn't someone ordering everyone around and setting some really strict structure on things. Cheryl and I also had that experience with a little bit more structure when we worked with the women's co-op groups in Durham. And with that, we had a very short time frame until Cheryl had put a fair amount of structure on it, and we'd given them like time frames. Okay, think about this stuff, think about this stuff. But then when they were talking, and they were talking about, we'd grouped them up, and as they were talking about whatever it was, if it wasn't what we had originally specified, we didn't change that. So that was important. So even if we came in with a structure because of time constraints or because of whatever reasons, it's going to be different in every situation. We don't stick to it. We take leadership where it's coming from. So when the group wanted to talk about, well, like, we hadn't realized that some of these co-ops hadn't started at all. They were really at the stages of how do we figure out a space for us to meet or something like that. That wasn't really a space that the platform cooperative movement and the development kit that we're making is looking at, like finding space for a co-op. But it made complete sense for that group to spend that hour trying to suss that part out. So that's a bit how it looks. I don't know if Cheryl and Dana have other insights from these examples that I've given.
Yeah, I found it really challenging because we didn't always, you know, we couldn't kind of to be in control, right, of the process entirely, which is a very uncomfortable place to be sometimes for me. But I think too, like, there was something in it about just kind of figuring out how to check in though, and how to say, okay, you know, just having a sense, like, you want to know what's going, you know, what's happening and where you are in the process throughout it, and making sure you're kind of on track somewhat. So there's a kind of balance of, you know, you want to be somewhat on track with your goals, but also being flexible. So it's just this kind of dance sort of balancing those things. And I think just kind of having checkpoints, or like, okay, you know, just want to be clear on where we're at now. Let's stop. Let's regroup. Let's check in. Okay, these are the options going forward, or, you know, so yeah, that seemed to be a good approach that I found. Yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, what you said about goals is so important, right? Because in my experience, there's a difference between, like, truly finding out what people want to talk about and what's important to them, and then having one really loud voice kind of derail the conversation. I think it's a very sensitive line to have to toggle, like, oh, this group is really interested in this, but what is the dynamic of the group like, for the lack of a better term, right? Because often in certain groups, while, like, we work in a certain way, there are still power dynamics in spaces that we enter. So I think being sensitive of that, and just seeing, like, oh, like, if this one person is kind of, like, dominating the conversation, what do other people want to talk about? You know, Michelle, you said it so well, like, the facilitator almost, like, not really participating or not being too hands-on until someone can't participate. Like, I really like that kind of as a mantra, as, like, something to keep in mind.
Okay, cool. Gregor, you wanted to share something? Hopefully the audio is working now.
It was Justin, actually.
Oh, there we go. Justin, go ahead.
No, there I go.
Okay. The stuff I was going to share was is more technical. Is that okay to want to keep this theme first?
You're super, super quiet. I mean, we hear you a bit, but really quiet.
That's probably partially me. Anyways, I was just saying my topic is going to be a little technical, so I didn't know if we wanted to keep going with this current theme first.
It's open, so anything goes. Share something that...
Change it up.
Okay, well, I'll just go for 2 to 5 minutes, and then we'll see what happens. Okay, let me see if I can share my screen. So we're trying out the new Zoom room setup, so we may or may not have technical difficulties.
Everybody share the local?
Yeah, sort of. Not through the local setup, but you can connect directly to the screen share without being in the meeting. Okay. So I got like a billion windows open because I wasn't quite ready. So what I wanted to share actually is just the window. So So I just wanted to show this somewhat helpful feature of browsers now. And it really depends on sort of what issue you're running into. But we're always trying to add the accessibility information into websites, web content, interactions that we're designing. And occasionally we run into cases where you're trying out a screen reader with the site and things just aren't behaving the way you're expecting it. Things look like you put it together correctly. So one of the new features that are newish features that we're seeing in browsers now is that they're exposing more of that accessibility information that they pass along. So here's an example in Safari, and you can see right here, so I'm inspecting this link, this Inclusive Design Research Center link, and it's gonna tell me the role it has. I don't know if you guys can see that. I don't know if I can make it bigger. So it tells you the role, it'll tell you the label, and that's some of the accessibility information that, you know, Safari is exposing. A lot of the other browsers will have similar features too, so I'll show you in Chrome. I'm going to have it open already. In Chrome, it'll show you the tree as well. Again, let me see if I can make this bigger. So I'll show you the RE attributes, which, you know, it's a link, so it doesn't really have any in this case. And it'll tell you the name and if you had specified a label or a label by title. And this could be useful too in this case if you thought you labeled something and maybe it's just missing. Maybe that label by element doesn't exist. And this might be able to help you track down some of the bugs you might be having. Oh, and here we can tell it's focusable or focused. Firefox also has this feature too, but you need to enable my Firefox window. Okay. You actually need to turn it on. So they have this accessibility tab in the developer view. And then it's you have to turn it on. And this is, I believe, for performance reasons. Again, we can look through and we'll inspect. Oops, sorry. We actually want to inspect the accessibility properties. And again, you'll see in this case the whole accessibility tree that it's exposing, as well as the specific information about it. It'll include some other stuff, I guess, here too, like states, relations, and attributes. So that's just a quick handy tool if something's not working the way you expect it, and you can deep dive down into see how stuff like the ARIA value attributes and other, like, you know, what kind of tags you're using is affecting the accessibility tree output from the browser to the system. That's it for me on this topic.
Cool. That's great. 50 seconds to spare. Yeah, any questions or comments about this particular tool?
I wonder if everybody on the call knows what an accessibility tree is. Do you want to explain a bit more there?
Oh, boy. I don't. Okay, well, hopefully I get this correct. Here, in this view here, it's just showing basically if you were to, you know, parse out this document into some sort of structured organization that something could then go and read through. I mean, HTML documents are already sort of hierarchically structured in a way, or they're structured documents. And this is just another representation of one. And something like a screen reader or other ATs, other system technologies would then read through this version to be able to output the information in a different format. So a screen reader would use this to explain, like, that this is a link. They wouldn't just necessarily read back the text. And you could add in other information, like if it's a menu, you might say it's expanded. And so this would contain information about that. Yeah, so it's just a bit more of a descriptive structure on the document so that an assistive technology or other tool can express it to someone.
Cool. Thank you. All right. Any questions? Otherwise, someone else can go ahead.
I'll go next. Can you hear me okay? Or yeah. So I don't have a laptop with me, but I just wanted to share from my experience with a technique called hand over hand. Some of you might already be familiar with it if you've been in a classroom setting. With arts programming is where my experience comes from. So I used to work as an arts facilitator in an arts rehab, and particularly working with youth and children. And this is a technique that I found very useful during my activities. You know, they were usually typically programs that had from as little a group as 6 to 8 participants, but they could also be in a setting where you're in a studio with up to almost 20 participants at a time. And this is a technique that, you know, just as it sounds hand over hand, you might think, okay, we have, you know, a painting activity, and therefore a facilitator can assist a participant or an individual with maybe mobility issues or challenges by simply putting their hand over top of theirs and allowing for some stabilization or some support with the need to follow through with that activity. And of course, there are various questions that arise during my time as a facilitator. I think amongst my peers, you know, and I'll pose these questions to you because I'd love your thoughts, but basically, you know, how much assistance is too much assistance, and how can we work collaboratively to allow the participants to be involved and participate in a way that grants them the most independence without taking away from their intentions and their goals for, you know, executing their project or their ideas. And also, how can we also respect that participation takes place in so many different ways and levels, and sometimes we participate by simply just observing. I know I myself like to participate by observing, sometimes multiple times before I actually dive into, you know, a practicing or, you know, experimenting with a material that's foreign to me. So these were all things that as a team in an art studio setting was really important and really valuable. And I can't stress enough how, you know, I definitely felt directly the effects of the funding cutbacks, because when an instructor or a teacher in an art setting has no support with the facilitators that we've called one-to-one facilitators, I mean, it immediately impacts how much an individual can take part in realizing a creative idea or project. And yeah, I don't know, you know, if any of you have any questions, but it's something that's really dear to me, and I think I've done it, you know, I'm no longer a facilitator in that sense, but it's a conversation I have with other people that had a role in that way. And I'm curious to know from, you know, other design perspectives, like, what are your thoughts on a technique like that in an art setting, in a classroom setting? I'll leave it at that.
Can you summarize again exactly what the technique was? I missed it in my notes, so I just want to make sure I capture it correctly.
So hand over hand is just, it implies basically that the facilitator, in a sense, in this case, in an arts studio setting, would provide support over the hand of a participant that maybe requires a little bit more stabilization or support to see through their activity. In some ways, it could be maybe somebody that's on the autism spectrum that requires, maybe might not want to come into direct contact with the material, and therefore the facilitator providing hand over hand could put their hand over theirs, and the facilitator would then come into contact with with the materials so that there's no sensory overload. That's one example, but yeah, that's essentially what the technique is.
So it's very much in a literal sense.
Yes.
And over it.
I can relate to that a little bit. I used to work with individuals with autism for many years, and we had to do that a lot, but it was in a different context because we would help them acquire a skill. So we would do a lot of hand over hand, but we would fade the prompt when they were acquiring the skill. So we would just feel if they were doing that on their own by observing, by feeling how much we had to prompt them physically. But it's different when you are in an art and design class because you also want to see, like it's completely different because for us, I mean, the parameters of what qualified as a skill that was acquired or not was very fixed. So we knew if we wanted somebody to touch something, it was easy to know whether the person touched it or not. But this is different because they are creating and you want them to interact with their material in the way they want. So I now you're making me think of this and I find, I don't know, I have no idea how to accomplish that piece. Where we are still giving them the freedom to create because we don't know where they are going with what they are doing, right? So I have no idea, yeah.
I know some of my colleagues at the IDRC have worked more directly with this, but I makes, and perhaps some are here and could speak to it, but makes me think about exactly what you're saying, sort of the starting point of creating art. And hand over hand is one great tool to support. But I also wonder about even stepping further back and create having art created in a way that is how the participants want to create. So it's not necessarily with hands. Perhaps I think there's been art creation by attaching to various sort of mobility devices and moving and things like that. So is it creating art in a way that, you know, we have these sort of expectations of maybe, you know, we think of painting, hand and brush, but it doesn't have to be that way. So I wonder about even taking a step further back and how art is created is really informed by the individual. And I think there's some work that's being done or has been done in the IDRC around that. I think, so at the demonstration school that I think we're working with, there was an artist in residence who talked quite a bit about that. He was with the school, not connected with the IDRC, but he came to an event. I'm not sure if anyone here knows his name, but his work was really based on working with and facilitating and allowing individuals with different needs to decide to create different ways for them to create their art.
Cool. That's a really interesting question. I thought of how do you facilitate while allowing a person to the freedom to create, and I think considering the individual and how they might want to create and sort of taking a step back and removing our sort of ingrained notions of how one is to create something. I think that's very useful.
But another part of it, John, just to jump in terms of this idea of individuality, I think a lot of our very romantic ideas about art is that it's an individual pursuit. It comes from us. But, you know, often, I mean, one of the things I learned certainly working with Patrick from Beverly, who was the artist in residence there, is that collectives can make art too, right? So some of the activities he would do and would involve having strings that connected the arms or legs of each of the artists in the group together so that, you know, and then they'd hang markers or paintballs or other things on that. And as they were dancing to music being played, art would be made through their collective actions, bringing them together. Similarly, a good jazz band is always going to be some meeting of individual expression with a collective act. So thinking both through individuality and collectivity. And art's a nice lens for always never making one or the other simple. I think we live in a really neoliberal world where individuality is always placed first. And of course, disability also challenges that. When you need help, when you have a need, it's also a way of bringing together the connections that we have as people.
And yeah, this makes like, this is really blowing my mind. All these ideas that everybody is saying, I find this amazing. It's making me think about challenging the ideas of normalcy, of what we assume that art should be like, where it should come from, because we have been doing it like that, because we have been exposed to that, but we have decided that. So yeah, I find this absolutely amazing. Yeah, thank you for sharing all this, yeah.
I have no experience of this, of hand over hand, but having just learned about it, it feels very much like teaching partner dance or a method that I've used in teaching partner dance, where I am physically connected to someone and I'm kind of showing them where I'm expecting them to move their body. But then I'm also at the same time listening very deeply with my body to where they are moving it or how they want to move or how they want me to move. So it although I might be the one teaching, and I put that in air quotes, I'm spending just as much time listening and learning. And I wonder if that's something that would be relevant to hand over hand as well.
Yeah, that definitely resonates with me, Michelle. And with what everyone has been contributing, I do think that even when we discuss like the minimal facilitation, I kind of saw some parallel to how a hand over hand type technique lends itself to like a limited structure. You're really just trying to provide that additional support and options, like giving a participant a right of choice to having those options, not necessarily saying this is the way or this is the activity, but saying like, you can observe or you can also take part in such a way, and having those additional supports, including people, right? Because facilitation with hand over hand requires another person to be present. And sometimes that's, you know, when Colin was bringing up the collaborative and the collective approach to arts making, that too comes into play with hand over hand, because you have sometimes a team of volunteers working with facilitators, and then they are working with the artist, and some level of communication has to take place in order to then, you know, part ways and then create collaboratively, create independently, if that's how a participant wishes to do so, and also providing that distance that might allow them to still be involved and engaged, but without, you know, maybe making it too daunting. I mean, I've experienced a setting where some participants want to be in the room and they want to be collaborating with everyone else, but they need a little bit more distance from the activity. And so how do you work together with volunteers, facilitators, and the instructors together to kind of make that happen?
This is super interesting. It just made me think of that organization. I think they're called Laser Eagles in Toronto. Has anybody heard of that group? I'll drop a link. Kind of related, like it's visual arts kind of collective. People with disabilities and others can come and sort of support their process physically, like through helping them create their artwork. And yeah, just made me think of that.
Cool. Yeah, if you could paste the link, that'd be cool. Anyone else have something that they would like to share with the group? I have a tool if people are interested. Okay, I'll just share. So it's a technical tool, and it'd be hard for me to share this because it's actually on my phone. But Google has this app called Recorder that they released maybe about a month or two ago. Basically, it is a auto transcriber that you could that's hosted 100% on your phone, so it's not actually sent to the cloud anywhere, so it's secure in that way. So basically, I'm going to activate it now on my phone, but I don't know if you can see that, but I'm talking and the transcriber is going along and just recording whatever I say. So what makes this tool interesting is you could use it, because there are lots of applications, so my mind is always thinking of new ways to use this tool. So I've seen this tool used by people who are doing job interviews, especially remote, where they would be using this recorder so that they could remember what kind of answers they gave. And then so when another subsequent question comes up, they would then quickly recall what it is that they saw, that they said, so they don't sort of contradict themselves and put themselves in a position where they have to sort of explain themselves out of a corner, sort of say. I've been trying to use this in settings where there's a speaker, a lecturer, and I've been toying with the idea of actually putting my headphones up to the microphone and having the transcriber record the lecturer as they're talking. You could also possibly use the recorder as a way of jump-starting captioning for video after the fact. So you could, if you know that something is being recorded, you could turn on your recorder to start transcribing the audio into text. And then afterward, when you want to put the captions to it, you already have a rough skeleton for all the captions. You could just go in and then put the timing codes in there and then fix the transcriptions and whatnot. So yeah, and it's a free tool that Android has. You could do something similar with, I know Microsoft Office has a dictation feature that they have in pretty much all their tools now. So you could do something similar with the dictation tool in Office products. And I'm sure Apple has something similar as well on their platform. So just, there's some interesting things that we could do with these dictation tools. Even when someone, I guess in a pinch, if we can't get an ASL interpreter, perhaps a tool like this might be useful in a pinch to provide some to provide a medium for someone who is hard of hearing to be able to understand the conversations that are happening within a room. So anyway, that's my tool.
John, that's really cool. I was at an event just after Deep that used a tool similar to this. I think there are a few that are out there. This one's in the cloud, so it's not local like you describe it. It's called Thiston. Just gonna paste the link here in the chat. I was impressed by it for a couple of reasons. It was used in an event. So they had two screens at the front of the room and Thiston was running throughout the entire event. And there were people in the room who had difficult to understand voices, people who had accents, people who were quieter speakers, people who were louder, like in other words, a diversity of speakers. And it was so good. It was really, really good. So they used Thiston instead of using a transcription service. And it's searchable, which is pretty cool too.
Cool. All right. Anyone else have anything that they'd like to share?
Jonathan, I was just, could you mention the name of the app or the tool that you shared?
Yeah, it's got a generic Google name, so it's just simply called Recorder. And if you go to the Google Play Store, you look up, just search up Recorder, and it should show up there.
Thank you.
That's really cool.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Sorry, Craker. Yeah, that's really, really cool. I'm always searching for really good audio to text. That also sort of can eliminate sort of ambient noise and can do reasonable punctuation without having to say period or so I'm not sure how that works. And I think, yeah, in support of sort of expanding education resources, especially open education resources, to be able to take audio files and more easily create transcriptions, I think is really, really valuable. I've tried doing it in Google Docs. I think under Chrome you can do an audio recording. I've tried or do a text transcription from audio, and it's really garbled and the punctuation is challenging in that, but that's sort of the goal, I think, from having multimodal of existing content is I think these types of platforms are pretty awesome.
Yeah, and I think, I guess, if we're talking about creation of learning materials in the classroom, this could be one interesting way of, if you know that a session in the classroom is being recorded, this could be a way of providing a flexible format for the content that's being taught, because it is ultimately just straight text. It could then be used in many different ways. So that's another way of just sort of giving life beyond the moment that's in the classroom.
Yeah, absolutely. And the whole challenge around note-taking, there's lots of support requests for note-taking in classes from elementary to high school to post-secondary, and all of the different types of supports that people are using. Like I've seen in elementary schools, other students being asked to supply their notes for students in their handwritten. So something like this could absolutely really, really benefit.
Yeah, but I have tried it in a room where there is ambient noise. It still functions okay, but I think if the intention is to have something that is a little more accurate, I think the person using the app should probably try to make arrangements to have the recorder sort of closer. I remember back in my day, they used to have those tape recorders, and I remember if people are skipping class, there'd be like a whole pile of tape recorders at the podium because people are skipping class or doing something else, and then they would come back after class to pick up their recorders. But I guess if the quality is important, they might want to find a good position for it. But the recorder app also records the audio. So it records both the text and the audio. So you get both formats through the app. So even if the transcription isn't great, you'll at least still have the audio file that you can listen to supplement. So there's always sort of like a fallback.
I was gonna say that I think it's really neat that this is all done on the device, since with a lot of these transcription services, you're subject to the privacy policies of some cloud service. Whereas with this, you know that the data is staying on your phone. You can like disconnect from the internet completely, I guess, and still use that, which might be very important to a lot of people. I'm surprised at how accurate it was. I downloaded it while you were talking, John, and sort of did a test run real quick, and it was really neat to watch it adjust itself and change the punctuation as you were speaking. thinking, you know, oh, is this the continuation of this sentence? No, it's a new sentence. So it changed it. And it cut out all your pauses and ums and ahs. It's very impressive. And I think very cool that it's all on the device proper.
Yeah, I also like that include, as well as the privacy implications of not having to send something to the cloud, if you have a poor connection, it'll still work really well, because that's, anyone who's ever tried to use Siri on a bad network knows that it's incredibly exasperating when you just see it sit there spinning and spinning and spinning. So it's pretty cool.
Anyone else have something that they would like to share? I don't want to feel like I'm hogging it, but I could always share something else. But I want to give other people an opportunity. All right. Okay. Fine. I'll go. This will be a quick one, and then other people could think of something to share. The one tool that let me quickly. I wonder if I could share my screen if I'm recording. There we go. It's called the Color Contrast Analyzer, and let me pull this up. Some of you may have already seen this before. There you go. It's so. Are you seeing that? The color contrast analyzer? Okay, cool. So basically, it's a way of being able to quickly discern whether or not the color combinations of the things that you're using in a design or image or what have you, it meets the requirements for a WCAG. So there's a feature here. You could use an eyedropper. You could pick colors, and then it would update. The results, and then basically it would give you the criteria that it meets down at the bottom. So whether or not it meets the minimum contrast for small text or large text. For different kinds of non-text and things like that. So it's just a very quick and easy way, especially if you're creating a design or you're implementing something in a website. It's just a quick and easy way of figuring out if you have sufficient contrast. And you could download this if you just Google a color contrast analyzer. It's created by the Paciello Group. And you'll be able to find it on their website. And it's cross, they have different versions for different platforms as well.
I'm glad you shared this one, Jonathan, because I, without having a background in design, this is one that I looked up on my own when I was helping with the website, just to help determine the color contrast, and I remember Googling it and landing it, thought it was really useful, very straightforward and intuitive, and I was able to share it with a team of people.
Yeah, I'm just gonna say for those that like muck around in the dev tools with the colors and stuff, in Firefox, in their color picker and their CSS selector, it'll actually tell you what the WCAG level it complies to as well.
This also makes me think of, I know more and more in design tools, they're building contrast checkers into the design tools themselves. Like I know Figma and Sketch have like a variety of different plugins, and I just quickly Googled this and I'm going to share an article by Figma of different plugins that kind of help with accessibility. So the first one is obviously around color contrast. There's another contrast checker. There's one for looking at color contrast for different sort of color blindness combinations. And then also there's one that I haven't looked too into called focus order, which looks like it allows you to annotate designs around focus order, which is pretty cool. I haven't tried it yet, but maybe worth looking into soon.
There's a couple of little things I can share. John, you reminded me of one, and then Michelle reminded me of another. So the first one is a color and contrast related tool that someone launched recently that I quite like. It's called Who Can Use, and it takes the color contrast that you provide and then it breaks down what different vision conditions do with those colors, including, there's obviously different color blindness, forms of color blindness, glaucoma, low vision, cataracts, but also it even shows you a rough approximation of what it'll look like if you're looking at it on a screen in direct sunlight, or if you're using a device with night shift mode enabled, because those are kind of things that people don't often, there's a lot of these things, it's hard to think about them unless you can sort of see what they look like. And I think this is sort of an interesting approach to conveying some of those nuances. And the thing that I really like about it is, if you want to show someone a comparison of two colors really easily, it lets you create a link that you can just share, and then they'll see the contrast that you've set up with the two colors that you're inputting. So that's one thing. And then the other thing that I ran into last week or the week before is just this great little way of highlighting when an image doesn't have alt text using CSS. So as you can see, I have this image of some delicious pizza and I've supplied an alt tag for it. But if I delete this and then save, oops, not that way. What it actually does is this CSS rule right here applies a blur to the image so that it immediately pops out as being something that hasn't been described. I think it's a great little way of catching those kind of things and revealing them to people who aren't cognizant of the implications of not properly labeling an image, because it just puts it right in your face. And even if you aren't using assistive technology, you can tell that something's up because the image is not perceivable. So I thought that was a neat trick.
That is a really neat trick. I have a question. What if it's a decorative image and the alt text is there but empty?
Oops, sorry, I muted. That rule is really, so it uses the not pseudo selector. So what it's looking for is images that don't have an alt tag at all. So if I put in an empty alt tag, it's going to reload and it will properly display the image. So the selector is smart enough to know that if an alt tag is there, whether it has content or not, if it's an empty alt tag, it'll still display the image, assuming that you know what you're doing. If the alt tag is absent altogether, it will blur it.
Ned, your first tool reminded me of this tool I used a while ago, and should we start using it, called, maybe folks have heard of it, SimDaltonism. It's another one of those tools where it's to look at what designs look like for different sorts of color blindness, but the cool thing is that it basically creates a little filter window over your screen. So you could really drag it over your sketch file or your Figma file or whatever you're doing design in, and you can basically see in real time what it looks like depending on, they have all sorts of different options there. So that's something I've used in the past when making components.
That's awesome.
Anyone else? Okay, we are about 10 minutes to 4 o'clock, but I think maybe this might be a good place to stop. I think, yeah, so thank you everyone for sharing all these wonderful tools. If this is something that's interesting, maybe we could do this again in a couple months' time after we've sort of had a chance to work and discover new different tools. And it's always sort of cool to sort of learn about new things. So I appreciate all of this.
Thanks, John.
Thanks so much, John.
That's a great chat. Yeah, I really enjoyed that.
Thank you.
Okay. Well. Okay, so I'll finish up the notes and I'll make sure to pass it on to the list so that everyone could have a link to all the things that was discussed today. Yeah, I guess that's it. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, all.
Thanks.
Have a good one.
Okay, thank you.